from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Farmers have now long used antibiotics to beef up their beef, plump up their chickens, their turkeys, their livestock. Cheap antibiotic powder mixed in with feed helps livestock pack on pounds. What about the antibiotics we humans are given for an ear infection or anything else? Could they incline us toward obesity? In the midst of our obesity epidemic, could there be more to this picture than diet and exercise? This hour on Point, could antibiotics be making us fat? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. If antibiotics fatten animals, could they fatten us too? Or does that sound like a dodge? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will go to Japan on the third anniversary of the disaster still unresolved at the Fukushima nuclear plant. But first, to antibiotics and obesity. We'll hear in a moment from a lead researcher on a potential link, but we go first to Peggy Kennedy of the New York Times. She explored the background here in a piece headlined, "The Fat Drug." Peggy Kennedy, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing a lot about this lately. It goes back, of course, initially to experiments and then more feeding with livestock. What, take us back to the first experiment in 1948 and what they found, Peggy.
Yes. You know, I began digging into this history a couple years ago when I found out that antibiotics originally entered animal feed not to protect the animals from disease, but because they were called back then and are still called a growth promoter. So my research led me to a character, a biochemist named Thomas Jukes, who worked for Laterly Labs, and he... When the lab was then developing a new drug called oreomycin, and Jukes had this idea that perhaps the drug could be given to animals to increase their growth. And so he tried this out in chickens, actually baby chicks, and he found that indeed this antibiotic produced much faster growth in the chickens. And then he became really an evangelist for this idea. And he began publishing a lot of research and working with other researchers. There was an enormous amount of research in the 1950s on whether antibiotics could make usually young animals grow faster and exactly how you could use them to do that.
And the conclusion scientifically and in practice was that it did, and farmers adopted this on a large scale. What they went and they started taking the, you report, Peggy, the antibiotic slurry, the sort of leftovers from drug companies, trucking them around in tanks and mixing them in with animal feed. Eli Lilly got into the business.
Yeah, and that was another piece of the story that really surprised me. In the early 50s, it was quite hard to create large quantities of antibiotics. And so the farms were so desperate for this kind of mash that was left over from the production of antibiotics that they competed to get this stuff trucked to them and immediately began using it. Lilly made I think they called it an aid to digestion, a powder that you could add in to your livestock feed to make these animals grow faster.
I mean, it's kind of another angle, but very much related, that if you brought in antibiotics, two things would happen at once. The livestock grew bigger, faster, and they would be protected against infections so they could live in what would have previously been considered dirty conditions, as you say, setting the stage for the factory farm.
Yeah, that was another thing that really surprised me. I think most of us think that antibiotics ended up in animal feed because the animals were living in, you know, filthy conditions or they were crowded together. But in the late 40s and early 50s, you know, this was old school farming. And so it was not, these were not factory farms. These animals were at first being given these antibiotics because of this mysterious property it seemed to have to make the young animals grow faster. And then once they were on antibiotics, of course, you could crowd them together and you didn't have to keep them as clean.
Bigger is better was kind of the mantra in those days. And in fact, this was used in an experiment on human children as well. Tell us about that.
Well, that was very disturbing. Jukes, and as well as a number of other researchers, some of them from the agricultural realm, of course, your first thought when you hear about this is, well, what would the antibiotics that humans take do to our bodies? And the kind of bizarre thing about looking back into this history is you find that back then people really they would brag about the weight of their baby and, you know, if
sure, bigger was better, period. Yeah.
Exactly. And so this did not strike them as a bad thing that human beings would grow bigger and fatter potentially from antibiotics. And so I read everything Jukes wrote and found in a very obscure place. I found him corresponding with a doctor at the Florida State farm for mentally disabled children in the 50s. And this doctor was trying to use the exact same regimen that was used on the farms on these children who were mentally disabled to make them grow faster and gain weight.
And in fact found that they gained almost 3 times as many pounds per year with an antibiotic supplement in their food.
Yes, he did. I mean, this was not, you know, I would not look to this as great scientific research. I think it's, you know, first of all, ethically troubling, but also, you know, this was not a published study. This was just sort of a gonzo experiment tried out on children.
Pagan, you're not making the case that the antibiotics fed to the livestock that in and of themselves are the main issue here. You're looking at actually antibiotics given to humans for medical purposes and this question of whether that might in humans have a similar pump up the volume effect.
Yeah, and this is a very confusing point, and I think Dr. Cho, who you're having on later, can also speak to this. But generally, it's certainly concerning that antibiotics would get into our food and water supply. But the amount that you take, you know, when you've got a infection would be it would be a lot more than what you would potentially be exposed to, from trace amounts in food and water. And children take, on average, 1 therapeutic dose a year of antibiotics. And now I want to emphasize that antibiotics are terrific, amazing, life-saving drugs. And if your doctor tells you to take antibiotics and you do, in fact, have a bacterial infection, you should absolutely take those drugs. I mean, you can't play around.
Antibiotics have been a salvation for millions and millions of people that might have died otherwise.
Yeah, they're very important drugs. But at the same time, new questions are coming up now in modern research about the effects of these drugs on our metabolism and on the bugs, the microbes that live in our gut and help us maintain our weight and digest food, and that, you know, scientists really have not figured out yet what's going on there. But
Pagan, I'm glad you raise all of that. I want to dive right into it while I have the time here. I appreciate your getting us started today. Pagan Kennelly of the New York Times, your piece is The Fat Drug. Pagan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
With us now from New York is Dr. Il-Sung Cho, Program Director of the Division of Gastroenterology, Professor of Medicine at the New York University School of Medicine, Principal Investigator in the Blazer Lab Group there, studying gastrointestinal health and disease. And he's co-author of several studies with Dr. Martin Blazer looking at the human microbiome, obesity, and antibiotics. Dr. Il-Sung Cho, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I've seen you describe antibiotics as potentially an X factor in our obesity epidemic. What do you mean by that?
I heard a little bit about what Pagan had talked about. You know, there are a lot of things that contribute to the obesity epidemic that we all know about, you know, sedentary lifestyle, poor dietary habits. But one of the things that we've been curious about in our lab is whether antibiotics and related to that, the bacteria that live within our digestive tracts can actually have a role in causing obesity. And it doesn't have to be a large role. I mean, even if you talk about a 5% increase, you know, in a 100-pound man, that's already a 5-pound weight gain.
Your colleague Marty Blazer has said that our poor diet and sedentary lifestyles alone are not enough to account fully for our obesity epidemic.
Well, so I think they all play a role. And you know, I think... we're looking for that extra little marginal gain or marginal detriment, I guess you could say in this case, that could lead somebody down the path to obesity.
So we'll look at how it might work, but bottom line, have you found so far in your research that human-level antibiotic consumption for medical reasons might in fact contribute to larger, heavier, fatter humans?
So we have some suggestions about this, yeah, certainly. We the studies that we've done have actually translated some of the observations that we're seeing in the agricultural industry to mouse models. So what we wanted to see was, you know, people have seen that giving antibiotics to different animals have caused them to gain weight. And when we talk about animals, we're not limited to one particular species. We're not talking about just cows. We're talking about all different types of mammals.
Chickens and turkeys and chickens, hogs,
turkeys,
and
pigs,
cattle,
everything.
Yeah.
Right. And it was limited to just antibacterial drugs. So antiviral medications, antifungal medications didn't work. So we had a fairly strong hint that we were talking specifically about the bacteria. And we said, all right, well, what might be the reason or what might be the steps that this could cause weight gain? And so we looked at this in a mouse model, and we saw that there were some analogs that we could use for this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about antibiotics and obesity, whether it's possible that antibiotics plump humans up the same way they do animals, livestock. We'll look a little later in this hour at Fukushima, 3 years after its tsunami disaster. Dr. Il-sung Cho is with us from the New York University School of Medicine. He is a principal investigator there in the Blazer Lab Group, studying the gut microbiome in gastrointestinal health and disease. And he's looked at connections between the microbiome, obesity, and antibiotics. Dr. Cho, Il-sung Cho, I want to make clear again here, you're not saying there are issues around antibiotics being fed to livestock. People debate that. There are plenty of issues around antibiotics and whether we're overusing them and what that does to our potential treatment down the road. But you're not saying that the antibiotics fed to livestock would be the cause of this antibiotic circumstance in humans. You're saying you're really talking about medical treatment with antibiotics.
So that's some of the research that we've done demonstrates that you know, intermittent use of antibiotics at a young age can lead to increased obesity. We've looked at this particularly specifically in mouse models, but there are some parallels that would suggest that might also play a role in humans as well.
And when you say intermittent, you mean on the kind of intermittent regularity that a child might have with antibiotics
right.
for an ear infection
right.
or whatever it might be.
Right. So I mean, when we talk about antibiotics given to cattle, they're given small doses every single day. But when children get it, they get it for an ear infection, they get it for a sore throat. There are a variety of reasons why a child might be exposed to it. And some of the work that we've done kind of demonstrates that obesity is a possible result of that.
How's the volume that a child would, you know, a child sort of with normal earaches and all the rest get in the course of childhood years compared to what livestock might get with regular everyday feeding with antibiotic-enhanced grain?
So it's hard to compare the two directly. But in a single, what we do know is that a single exposure to an antibiotic can actually significantly change the population of bacteria that live within the gut. And that's what we've been referring to when we talk about the microbiome. It's this community of bacteria that live within a human digestive tract. And we know that there's certainly a lot of data out there that shows that, you know, significant antibiotic use can change your bacterial community permanently, that severe infections, like if you get a big diarrheal illness, that could potentially alter your microbiome completely and permanently. And what we were very interested in is how do those bacteria within the gut contribute to obesity?
Got one listener here, Aldona, writing to us, Dr. Cho. She says, it's all about the gut flora. Which antibiotic changes to our detriment, she writes. Good flora keeps you lean. In the old days, we all ate fermented food to help with gut flora. Ferment your own cabbage and sauerkraut, and she says, and eat grass-fed wild chicken meat. Is she on the right track there? Does that line up with what your research is finding?
So I think that there are some truths in what she's saying. So I think what we've underestimated for a long time is the role that the microbiome, so the gut flora was the older term that we used, but we don't really use that anymore.
Okay.
Because flora refers to flowers and plants, and we don't
really use
them.
You're talking bacteria, so the microbiome,
right.
All right.
Right. And so what we do appreciate now, though, is that the volume of bacteria within our gut probably plays a very important role in health and in diseases. So just to kind of give the listeners a sense of how much we're talking about, if you count up all the number of cells that you have in your body, your own cells,
yep.
And then you count up all the number of bacteria that live on your body, the bacterial cells actually outnumber the human cells by a factor of 10. That means you're 10 times more bacteria than human.
That I'll have to really contemplate that over time. But are you really suggesting here, when we talk about obesity, it's not just individual. We have an obesity. It's often described as an epidemic in this country. Are you suggesting that our normal antibiotic intake in the course of childhood has tilted the entire American population on balance toward predilection toward obesity?
I think it's a little hard to say that it's tilted the entire population, but on certain individual cases, yes, I do think that changing your microbiome by the use of antibiotics can put you at risk for obesity. And this is in conjunction with other risk factors like diet and,
of course,
and exercise. But yes, I mean, I do think that the differences in microbiome can account for some differences in body composition. Sure.
Let's take a call from Columbus, Georgia. Brenda's calling. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. From my understanding, I've been listening, and I also read the article in the Times recently. When farmers gave large amounts of antibiotics to livestock in their feed, it produced more animal tissue that then could be sold by the pound in the grocery store.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing from the farmer's point of view. Translating that to humans, an obese human, from my perspective, has a fat layer that would be unacceptable from a livestock point of view. And I hear everyone's talking about bigger, heavier, but nobody is saying what kind of tissue you're getting. I'm saying it's implausible that, because first of all, humans are not eating antibiotics, and they're not even getting it in medical doses anywhere near the amount that animals are getting it in their feed. Plus, we are producing humans with a gigantic fat layer, and we're producing animals. They must be producing more lean tissue because that's what we want. Nobody wants a chicken with a one-inch fat layer.
Brenda, good questions all. Dr. Cho, what do you say? Do the antibiotics in livestock produce muscle or fat? And what about Brenda's observations on humans?
All right, so it's actually a very good observation. And sure, we don't. You know, we're talking about obesity specifically and not that we're gaining more muscle. And actually, interestingly, when we did some work in our mice and we gave the mice antibiotics, what we found is that the mice, when you look at their overall weight and you looked at the mice that didn't get antibiotics and you compared them to the mice that did get antibiotics, their overall weight was actually the same. But when you then broke down the mouse into lean mass, fat mass, bone density, fat mass was actually what was increased in the mice that had received antibiotics. So the phenotype, what we're seeing in terms of the big picture, is that in the mice that got antibiotics, they actually had more fat. They were more obese. They had more adipose tissue. So that seems to correlate more with what we see in humans.
So you're saying that in humans, it could indeed create more fat than muscle?
Yes.
Brenda also says, look, we just don't eat as much as livestock. But you're saying actually it's quite intense and we do get treatment and that single or a small number of events could change the microbiome, the gut bacteria, for a long time.
Right. So the single courses of antibiotics, one dose of antibiotics may or may not change it permanently. But there is certainly a lot of data out there that says that a course of antibiotics, whether you take antibiotics for a week or so, can shift your microbiome permanently. One of the interesting things, though, is that if you and I take the same antibiotic, it may not shift our microbiome the same way. You would think that they would, but, you know, we don't. And that's one of the difficulties in this field is that each individual and their community of bacteria respond very uniquely to particular pressures like antibiotics.
Yeah, Kate writes to us. She said, I wish I could blame it on antibiotics, but she says, I've been a vegetarian, no meat, no fish, no poultry for over 40 years. And unfortunately, Kate writes, I'm significantly overweight despite all I try. Anita in Chesapeake, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This conversation is very disturbing. I have a 40-year-old in my life who was a very petite child at birth and remained petite up until she was about two. And started developing ear infections, and the doctors have kept her on one antibiotic after the next for the last 2 years. From September last year, she went from a size 4 to now a size 7.
So she's gotten a lot bigger in a hurry, is it obese type? Is it fat?
Yes, it's the obese kind of fat. Mm-hmm. It's a pudgy type of fat, and it's not from her diet. She's not. We don't eat fast food. She has fruits versus fruit juices. She has vegetables. She loves vegetables, whole grains. A very, very healthy lifestyle. Yet she keeps gaining weight.
Anita, let me take it to Dr. Cho. Il-Sung Cho, what do you say?
So, you know, the development of obesity actually has so many factors involved, and the antibiotic use can certainly be one of them. As you had mentioned, you know, even though she hadn't changed her diet, you know, there are a lot of other things that can be in play, physical activity. And actually, some of the work that's being done now has shown that if you change the bacteria within your gut, that can actually affect hormones within your GI tract. Hormones that can affect how satiated you feel mm-hmm. after a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all these things combined could kind of snowball in certain individuals. I'm not saying that this will happen in every single individual, but in certain individuals, you kind of may get a perfect storm of all these things that could lead to obesity.
The microbiome, the bacteria in our gut, very influential, and you can see how antibiotics go straight to that issue. Il-Sung Cho, please stand by in New York. I want to welcome Dr. James Levine into our conversation from Phoenix, Arizona, professor of medicine at Arizona State, expert in obesity research. He's co-director of the Mayo Clinic Arizona State University Obesity Solutions Initiative. Dr. Levine, thank you for joining us.
Tom, what a pleasure. How lovely to hear from you.
What do you think of this notion that beyond issues of food consumption, our diet, and exercise, there may be some X factor in our national obesity epidemic, and that it might possibly point toward antibiotic use? How does it strike you?
I've been listening to this absolutely fascinating debate, and there are probably a multitude of X factors associated with obesity, media, social issues, psychological issues. Poverty is a major, major driver of obesity. Of course, our food environments, our activity environments, infrastructure, there are developmental, biological, medical issues, all associated as X factors with obesity. And whether antibiotic exposure is one of them really, really in fairness, I think remains to be determined. Professor Cho's beautiful studies conducted in baby mice are of course, intriguing. They showed no changes in mice body weight, but really the changes, as he pointed out, were in body composition in the baby mice. And so, you know, how this translates to humans is, I think, absolutely remains to be identified. However, all of that said and done, I must emphasize one critical, critical point.
Yes.
If today you are a parent going to take one of your children to the physician or the doctor's or healthcare provider's office, and they recommend antibiotics for a medical therapy, this is not a reason to fail to adhere to their advice.
If Don't
a physician
duck it.
Or healthcare
right.
provider
right. Yep.
Prescribes antibiotics, you must follow that advice exactly as prescribed. This is not a relevant issue in that context at this point in time.
Loud and clear. Dr. Levine, what about the role of the microbiome in our body mass? Dr. Cho is very focused on this, the bacteria in our gut and its potential to sway our weight, our potential obesity.
And again, just so your listeners know, I mean, Dr. Cho is literally a world authority on this issue, and it's a pleasure to hear from him today. The relevance of the gut microbiome is changing for multiple reasons. As you know, we all I hate to tell you this, we all have bouts of diarrhea, for example.
Yep.
And during that period of time, our gut biome completely changes. But then, of course, it recovers. We all, from time to time, take antibiotics. Our gut can change then, but of course it recovers. And so this is a living and dynamic force. Now, and it is therefore self-evident that it's important in biology how precisely it contributes and to what degree in obesity. I think the jury is out on that.
Let's go to Jim in Huntington, Vermont. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling because I raise alpacas, and they're a pseudo-ruminant. And obviously the, whatever you're calling it, the flora in their gut is relatively important to them, to the point where if in some cases they'll actually replace it. My question has to deal with, and I'm not sure how to word it as a question, probiotics and feeding probiotics to a pseudo-ruminant to increase gut bacterial action. And why wouldn't we do that with people?
It's a good question. Dr. Cho, I guess two things then. First, Dr. Levine in Phoenix reminds us that you can have health issues that sort of flush a lot of that microbiome and it can change dramatically. So are you saying that childhood antibiotic consumption could have a permanent or lifetime change in our microbiome? And what about our caller's question about probiotics and whether there are ways that we might enhance the health of our microbiome to reduce a proclivity toward obesity?
So I actually very much appreciate Dr. Levine's comments, and I think what he says is very important. We do have, there are some suggestions that early exposure in mouse models can change the microbiome permanently. Now, whether that translates to humans, and as Dr. Levine has suggested, how to what degree, that remains to be seen. It's kind of moving in, that segues into the caller's question about probiotics. One of the difficulties that we have right now is that we don't know clearly how different bacteria affect each individual. So, whether I could give somebody a probiotic, which is helpful in certain situations for things like irritable bowel, some of those may not actually help anybody, or some of them may harm people. We don't know how people individually react to a particular bacteria in their gut remains to be seen. So, a lot of the work that's being done now is exploratory. We're trying to find novel mechanisms for obesity. And again, it kind of plays into the universe of factors that can make a certain individual obese. And again, I would also reiterate what Dr. Levine had said. I mean, both of us are physicians first, and so when somebody is prescribed an antibiotic, it's very important that they do that because that take the antibiotics as prescribed because in the immediate instance, that's more important. Right now, we're exploring these kind of novel hypotheses about what can cause obesity, and the way, microbiome is certainly a possible player in this. But in the immediate setting, if your child has an infection and you're given antibiotics, it's important that they take that.
If you have a medical condition today or a child today who's prescribed antibiotics, do not duck them in response to what you're hearing here. At the same time, we're learning about some very interesting medical contemplation, scientific contemplation of some potential factors in a national obesity epidemic. And I'm grateful to the two of you for helping us do that. Dr. Il-sung Cho at the New York University School of Medicine, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Cho.
No, thank you for having me.
And Dr. James Levine at Arizona State, at the Mayo Clinic Arizona State University Obesity Solutions Initiative. Dr. Levine, thank you very much for your time and insights.
My pleasure.
Take a short break, come back, and look at Fukushima, 3 years after the earthquake and tsunami that led to meltdown there. We'll look at where it stands today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 3 years ago today at 12:49 p.m., March 11th in Japan, one of the worst nuclear power plant disasters ever was just beginning. The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, 150 miles northeast of Tokyo, was hit by a tsunami, causing what would become a catastrophic failure and the meltdown of three nuclear reactors. 3 years later, Fukushima is an unresolved disaster. We want to look at where it stands in Japan's internal debate on nuclear power. What are the lessons from Fukushima? What have we learned? On Sunday, thousands gathered in front of the Japanese parliament. Japan is considering cranking back up its nuclear power industry while Fukushima is still unresolved. Here's the sound of protesters in Tokyo on Sunday. They're waving signs there that say, "Sayonara, nukes." But that is not necessarily the direction that Japan is headed in. With me now from Tokyo with the latest is Antoni Sladkovsky, correspondent for Reuters, who's reported on Fukushima. Antoni, thank you very much for joining us today. What is the status of the power plant, the nuclear power plant of Fukushima, as we speak right now? What's the level of safety or danger at the plant?
Hi, Tom. I think there are two major tasks that are being carried out at the Fukushima plant at the moment. One is, TEPCO, looks after the plant and manages it. It's taking out fuel rods from reactor number 4. Some of those fuel rods may be damaged, and it's a very delicate and complex process. Because what used to be, those fuel rods would be normally taken out by a machine. Because everything was damaged during the explosions 3 years ago, those fuel rods are now being taken out by workers themselves, and in an attempt to store them in a safe facility. And that is a very, very slow and very painstaking process, which is taking a long time. At the same time, other reactors are being cooled with water, and as that water during that cooling process gets contaminated, it's being stored in massive tanks, some of them as big as 1,000 tons. And storing that water and managing that water is very challenging, as we've seen only as recently as last month, when Fukushima suffered a 100-ton leak from one of the tanks. So these are the two processes that are being carried out in parallel inside the Fukushima plant. And it's a very fragile and very delicate process. Fukushima suffered many leaks over the last 3 years. And it's a process that it's about to cost billions of dollars and last at least 3 to 4 decades going forward. So right now the plant appears to be safe, but it's a very precarious and very delicate process as we go. That will take decades to complete.
That would be safe with very large quotation marks. I mean, the danger inside goes on. The water cooling and the accumulation of radioactive water goes on, unresolved, as people say. What about Japan's nuclear policy? They shut down all of their nuclear plants, as I understand it, after the Fukushima disaster, and now they're considering reopening, which is, I guess, what brought out some of these protests in Tokyo. What's on the table, Antoni?
Japan closed all the nuclear power plants. Then they restarted, the government restarted two reactors, but the rest has been closed. And right now the government is considering very seriously the reopening of at least some of the reactors. And this is obviously causing protests, and many local politicians are also against reopening of the nuclear plants in their prefectures, in their areas. So this is causing a lot of tensions, and actually nuclear power and the future of nuclear industry has been, that was one of the key issues during Tokyo mayoral elections that took place just a few weeks ago. But it looks as if the government is probably going to go ahead with the it considers nuclear power a vital source of power in official documents, and it is likely to reopen at least some of the reactors in the future.
Anthony Slodkovsky with Reuters in Tokyo. Thank you very much for being with us, Anthony. I appreciate your report for us today. Very mixed opinion in Japan over what to do on exactly this front on Sunday, again in Tokyo. Thousands of protesters gathered there. Former Prime Minister Naoto Kan, who was Prime Minister when Fukushima melted down, addressed the crowd in Tokyo.
I believe that now is the crucial time for us to eliminate nuclear power, or we forgive the Abe administration, which is going in the opposite direction.
Shinzo Abe, the current Prime Minister of Japan, his administration issued a draft of a new energy proposal calling to reopen nuclear power plants shut down after Fukushima. This was a reversal of Kan's policy. Here we have Toshikazu Okuya, the Minister of Economy, with the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, telling NPR that Japan faces an energy crisis.
Our dependence on imported oil is now higher than during the oil shock of 1973. We cannot say we're enjoying a stable energy supply now. The increased cost of importing fuels has had a big negative impact on our balance of trade. That's the reality we face.
I want to turn to a researcher who spent a lot of time looking at nuclear power and the fallout in Fukushima. Edward Lyman joins us from Washington, senior scientist of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, a group generally critical of nuclear power safety. He's former president of the Nuclear Control Institute, Washington-based organization focused on proliferation, co-author with David Lockbaum and Susan Q. Stranahan of the new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Edwin Lyman, Ed, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom.
At its worst, and you tell us when that was, how great was the danger here?
The danger to the United States from Fukushima?
The danger, period, to the world.
As bad as the accident was, it was not the worst case. Most of the radioactivity in the reactor cores is still there, so that makes the remediation decommissioning a major challenge, but I think parts of the world like the West Coast of the United States were spared what could have been a more serious event.
What is the threat now in Fukushima?
Well, the biggest threat really is still in the future. You have, there were 160,000 people who were evacuated in the months after the accident from areas that are contaminated. And they face a very difficult question. Even if the government says it's safe to return, the radiation levels are generally going to be greater than they were before the accident. So these people are going to be faced with a decision of living with more radiation and being able to return to their homes or not. And no one should be put into that position. But the majority of the radiation exposure is still in the future.
Does Japan know how to deal with the remaining challenge at Fukushima, or are they treading water? All these massive tanks are filling with radioactive water. Is it clear that they know what to do, how to fix this?
Yeah, I don't know if treading water is the right analogy. They cannot currently control the leakage of radioactive water from the site, and that's because the reactors are at the edge of the sea, and have hills to their west, and so there's a constant flux of rainwater and groundwater that's running through the site, and that is mingling with some of the radioactive water that's leaking from the damaged reactors and providing a steady source of contamination of the sea and the fisheries in the vicinity. They have a plan to build what they call an ice dam, to freeze the soil around the site so that water will flow around it, not through it, but there's a lot of skepticism if that's going to work.
So here we are in Japan now looking at restarting more of its nuclear industry. Naoto Kan, who was prime minister at the time of Fukushima, has described how he was, what his mind was changed overnight by what he saw happen on his watch at Fukushima, that he commissioned a report for what might have been a worst-case scenario there, found that they might have required a potential evacuation area as far as 250 kilometers from the power plant. That would have meant affecting 50 million people, and he decided no more nuclear industry. Under Shinzo Abe, that's turning around. Why?
Well, the nuclear power has been very important to Japan for decades. It's it's been a big part of their image of self-reliance. And so it's not surprising that the nuclear bureaucracy has once again taken hold. But the danger is that that this political pressure is going to overwhelm the regulatory agency that was created to try to establish a more independent safety basis. The Nuclear Regulation Authority was stood up to try to be more independent of the government's promotion of nuclear power, but they seem to be overwhelmed by the technical demands of their own requirements and this big push coming now from the central government. So we'll have to see if they're going to be able to maintain their integrity and independence and make decisions about restarts based on their new safety rules.
Ed Lyman, stand by. Let me get a call or two here. Norman in Cleveland, Ohio. Norman, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
My question is the ocean and the ocean surrounding Fukushima.
Yeah.
And the fish that live in the ocean and the fish that travel with currents, are these fish going to be safe to eat? Is there going to be any way of testing them as they get caught on the West Coast
of the United States? Ed Lyman, what do you say for catch near the United States, for catch anywhere, near Japan or elsewhere in the Pacific, Ed Lyman?
Yes, well, there are the fisheries directly adjacent to the site have been closed. But since the fishing industry is so important to Japan, they have been making efforts to try to reopen as many fisheries as they can. And when they catch fish in those other waters, they do sampling. But sampling, you can't sample every fish. And the problem is there's significant variability from one catch to another from day to day. So mistakes do happen. In fact, only last month, the Japanese government recalled a catch of fish because the day after that catch was sent to market, they tested a similar catch and found very high levels of contamination. So, there are going to be mistakes that happen because you just can't sample everything. Now, here in the United States, there are some fish that migrate a long distance, like bluefin tuna, and they have found relatively low levels of cesium contamination in fish caught off the California coast. But even though there's no safe level of radiation. So if you're eating fish that's been contaminated by Fukushima, that is additional radiation that you're exposed to. But it is proportional to the dose, and I don't think those exposures look like they're going to be a serious increase in people's risk.
But as you point out, there's not a way to know specifically on any given bite of fish exactly what's there, and no dose is a good dose. What lessons, fundamental lessons, do you see as having been learned or remain to be learned from Fukushima?
Well, the main lesson that should be learned is that the nuclear industry and regulators around the world simply did not have a good grasp of the potential threat to nuclear power that could lead to this kind of a disaster. And although there's been a lot of lip service to the lessons coming out of Fukushima, we're concerned that regulators are not fully absorbing those lessons and remaking the system of nuclear regulation to the extent that they can protect plants from what comes in the future.
What would that kind of remake mean for plants in this country?
It would mean expanding significantly the range of accidents that plants would be required to show that they could withstand. What we have now is a half-hearted approach where the industry is adding piecemeal additional bits of equipment, which they hope will still be available in the event that a reactor is exposed to a major natural disaster. But they're not doing the kind of comprehensive analysis to show that their assumptions are going to be correct. And we think that is the same problem that occurred at Fukushima, where there were simply assumptions where you didn't have to worry about certain contingencies, and then when you're faced with those contingencies, you didn't know what to do.
Ed, let's just look at Fukushima for another minute. People are talking about this taking decades to clean up. What about the remaining risk there during this time where there's active radioactivity there? It's not fully controlled. They haven't figured out how to clean it up entirely yet. What's the potential risk scenario with Fukushima even now?
Well, the good thing about nuclear power plants is once they are shut down, the fuel does cool over time. So the if there is another earthquake or a massive flood that overwhelms their jerry-rigged cooling system, then they will have a longer period of time to be able to restore cooling and prevent more damage.
What if that earthquake happened today? Is it cooled enough to be safe by any? Surely not.
Well, they have made some seismic improvements to some of the weaker parts of the plant, like the spent fuel pool in Unit 4, but the cooling system is relatively vulnerable. It's many meters of tubing that are exposed to the elements, and they have not been reinforced against massive earthquakes. The site has experienced many earthquakes of varying sizes since the accident. There has not been a catastrophe, but it is a pretty fragile system even today.
A fragile system 3 years after the earthquake, then tsunami, that led to meltdown at Fukushima. Edwin Lyman is senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of Fukushima, the story of a nuclear disaster. Ed Lyman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Emily Alphen Johnson, Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Claire Lancaster and Sarah Platt, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.